This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There's a war going on in the psychiatric world. It's over the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on Mental Illness. It's the DSM, and it is possible that you've had some experience with it yourself if you've ever sought help. Depression, social anxiety disorder, schizophrenia are among the illnesses defined in the DSM. Mental health professionals use this book as their diagnostic Bible. The fight is over the upcoming fifth edition of the DSM. Experts are divided on what to include, what to change, and what to exclude. Joining us now from WNPR in Connecticut is Gary Greenberg. He wrote an article on the DSM controversy in the December issue of Wired magazine. He's also a practicing psychotherapist, freelance journalist, and the author of Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of Modern Disease. Welcome, Gary. Good to have you.
Glad to be here.
Also with us in the studio, Mike Mayer. He's a senior partner of the Community Resource Alliance, based in part in Mebane, North Carolina. That firm offers consulting and training related to mental health and developmental disabilities. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Gary, let me start with you and ask about the DSM, how this got started. Tell us about the DSM.
The DSM is a book that psychiatrists, as you mentioned before, use to diagnose mental illness. It got started really a long time ago when there was an interest in just doing a census of mental patients and sorting them into their various categories. And over the years, starting in the middle of the 19th century, evolved into a manual that was used to develop a common language for clinicians and researchers to use in their work.
And so, Mike, this is important because it does standardize diagnoses and it helps in your business if you're trying to consult and guide people, right? Tell us about the value of this.
Yeah, it does help because when you're trying to figure out what it is that's going on, there are some things you want to be able to rule out. And you say, but it isn't this and it isn't this, and then have a list. And I know there's even some controversy about the way they've, you know, created the lists over the years that identify what the symptoms are. But our perspective basically is that it's better to have something to guide us than nothing to guide us. It'd be better if it was more research-based than just observation-based. But when we're trying to help organizations or individual practitioners figure out how to treat someone, it's much easier if they have at least a general sense of what might be going on for that individual rather than just throwing a dart and hitting a diagnosis that way.
And it helps the professionals, but it also legitimizes the illness itself so that people on the outside aren't saying, you know, by having a standard, we can't just say, well, it's all in your head.
Well, exactly. And that's part of the problem that we still have in general is that we still have stigma associated with mental illness. And in this process of identifying common language and a standard set of symptoms that we believe are representative of that diagnosis, we can say, you know, it's clear that this is not something that somebody is manufacturing, but it is a truly legitimate illness of the brain.
The hard part is how we come to those definitions, Gary, and that gets us into controversy. Tell us how you got involved in writing about the DSM-5 controversy.
Well, the DSM-5 controversy, how I got involved is that I was approached by a magazine to write an article about it. The controversy, however, is well known within my profession, the psychotherapy profession, because we're all awaiting, anxiously or otherwise, the publication of the DSM-5, which has now been put off for 2 years. And the controversy really has to do with what Mike just mentioned, which is this idea that somehow by making these diagnoses, we're talking about what's going on in the brain. That's what psychiatrists have been hoping for many years. But in fact, the DSM doesn't, the DSM-4 didn't, and the DSM-5 won't map its illnesses onto the brain. We're many, many years away from being able to do that, if it's even possible at all, and there's great doubt about whether or not it's possible. So the controversy arises because even though that paradigm is not yet ready, psychiatrists, for various reasons, need a new DSM. There's really two reasons. One of them is that research has shown that the DSM is lacking in many ways. It it doesn't really work very well with real-life patients, the existing edition. And the second reason, frankly, is that the American Psychiatric Association is dependent for its income, for at least 10% of its income and more when the editions first come out, on continually publishing new diagnostic manuals that clinicians and researchers have to purchase at the cost of about $75 each. The DSM-IV has generated over $100 million in sales since it was published in 1994. And as I say, it's even on the off years, it's worth 10% of the APA's budget. So they need to continue to renew their franchise for both financial and scientific reasons on naming people's psychiatric suffering.
Well, let's get a sense of how this comes about, how this conversation takes place, and how each new DSM is changed and then brought to market. And to do that, we're joined by Jane Costello. She is co-director of the Center for Developmental Epidemiology at Duke's Medical School, and she used to be involved in the revisions for DSM-5. Jane, welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Give us an idea of what goes on in those conversations. How do you do this?
Well, the DSM-5 procedure consists of a number of work groups, and these are made up of people who have professional, clinical, and research experience in a particular area. And that group gets together and goes through the diagnoses that are in its particular area of concern and reviews the literature, takes into account clinical findings, and tries to come up with changes as and when they're appropriate. The group that I worked with, which was the work group on child and adolescent disorders, started from a conservative position that we would not change anything unless there was strong evidence based on research that that particular area needed to be changed. I was not involved in many of the other groups. I did sit in on some of the anxiety work groups, conference calls, but I don't know about other groups, so I can't say to what extent research drove the changes that they made.
But you did decide to resign. Tell us why.
The main reason was that I was very concerned about the lack of research underpinning the changes that were being bandied about in conferences. I feel very strongly that unless we have research evidence to back a change, it's very harmful to patients, and certainly for me as a researcher, it's a terrible nuisance to have everything changed for no very good reason. I was very concerned that there was so little going into research. The whole process had started, in any case, much too late for much research to have been done. You know, ideally, a research agenda would have been produced alongside DSM-IV in 1994 that could have guided the next edition.
This question, because this question of research seems to have plagued every DSM from starting from number one. We get to number four, and its primary author, I suppose, you can correct me if that's not the way to characterize Al Francis, was one of the ones who really brought this controversy into the public. Gary, tell us about him and what it was in particular that he was concerned about.
Well, Al is immediately concerned with exactly what Jane was just talking about, which is that the ambition behind the DSM-5 to change a lot of diagnostic language and procedures is really worrisome in the absence of research and in the absence of time to conduct the research. But there's a bigger problem that Al's objections get to, and that is that psychiatrists haven't quite yet figured out how to define mental illness. So the entire field has a problem at its foundation, and there have been some more and less successful workarounds for that problem. But when you go to revamp your diagnostic manual, it becomes that problem becomes important, because in either changing or adding or deleting mental illnesses, if you don't know what makes a mental illness in the first place, then these every one of those decisions becomes fraught and rife with controversy, and also, as Al is particularly concerned about, the possibility of unintended consequences, so that small changes might result in large-scale problems in the population. As an example, a very small change in the DSM-4 made it possible for a number of children to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And as a result of those diagnoses, many children were medicated with very powerful antipsychotic drugs, which are, in addition to whatever their effects on the developing brain, are also drugs that can lead to diabetes and obesity. This is a problem that Al saw happening because of his work. And as a result, I think he feels even more strongly compelled to speak out about the kinds of issues that Jane is talking about. Every time you make a change, particularly in the absence of knowing what a mental illness is and isn't, you risk unintended consequences like that.
But Mike Mayer, from your point of view, somebody who has to rely on some standard in order to give any kind of guidance, isn't the problem of research the problem of psychiatry to begin with, because we don't have the kind of blood test and graphic imaging that we have in internal medicine and other kinds of medicine?
Oh, absolutely. We're still in our infancy in a lot of those areas. You know, we can do things like high orbital glucose tests, and we can get some sense of what's going on. We can start looking at some brain imaging and have some sense of what's going on. But the truth of the matter is that this type of testing has not been typically valued by society the way we have done with cancer research or any of the other things. So consequently, people like Jane, who are out there trying to do the epidemiology and figure out what is really going on behind all these things within our brains, within our central nervous systems, within the whole body, they're just not there. And so it does make it very, very difficult. And again, I go, understanding the controversy, but it's I still believe that DSM-4 is a better thing than DSM-0. I think it's better for us to have something than nothing, but I also think we need to be very careful about how we go forward.
Jane?
I was going to make exactly the same point as Mike, that some form of communication amongst all the people who are caring for people with mental illnesses is tremendously important, and I wouldn't want us to undervalue that.
But, Gary, you know, you talked about depression and I don't think you did. I think you talked about bipolar, the explosion of diagnoses in that after a change. Al Francis worried about depression as well, autism, and attention deficit disorder, all of which were changed slightly in the DSM-4. What kind of research would be required to make those adjustments, to validate those adjustments? Do we have the maybe I'll put the question to Gary Greenberg. Do we have the technology to make the kind of research that you're looking for that would satisfy you and Al Francis?
Well, statistically and epidemiologically, we probably have the ability to sort people into categories according to their behavior and other evidence of their consciousness. But the kind of evidence that we usually associate with diseases, I think saying that we're in the infancy is being really generous. I think actually looking back at this time, 100 years from now, regarding the conclusions we've drawn from functional imaging and so on, I think that we're going to look at our best like we're in the dark ages, and at our worst like we've inflicted damage on people, in the same way that we look back now on phrenologists as sort of harmless but wrong, or on lobotomists as both harmful and wrong. So I think that while it's true that it's very important to have a common language, a DSM that has a common language, that's primarily for the benefit of the clinicians. It's not entirely clear to me that it works for the benefit of the patients. And I think that it's very easy – the three of us here appear to be professionals – it's very easy to lose sight of the fact that when a person is given a diagnostic label, whether it's cancer or bipolar disorder, that person's identity changes. It's a very powerful thing to do. And when the research behind it when the label claims to be a medical label, people take that very seriously. They start to think of themselves as having that disorder.
Well, and that brings us But forgive me for interrupting, but it does bring us to one of the important controversies over the DSM-5, which is a possible new diagnosis, something called psychosis risk syndrome. Gary, tell us about that.
Well, psychosis risk syndrome arises, like most of these things, out of really good intentions. Clinicians notice that you get a kid in who's 14 years old, 15 years old, and they're not – they don't qualify for a diagnosis of a psychotic disorder, and yet they're clearly not normal. They're having maybe some disordered thoughts. They maybe have the occasional hallucination or maybe delusion, or they're just agitated in a way that doesn't fit into the diagnostic criteria. And it turns out that if you follow these people, some percentage of them actually go on to develop psychoses, particularly schizophrenia. So the idea was, let's figure out what those kids look like. They're mostly adolescents. Let's figure out what they look like and follow them. Use the criteria to identify a population and follow them. And it turns out that maybe one in four of them actually does become psychotic. So the idea was advanced. Let's turn that into a disorder called psychosis risk syndrome. Now, the people who originated it aren't interested, you know, for nefarious reasons in medicating children. However, if you create a diagnosis in the DSM, it is very likely that the pharmaceutical industry will then try to develop medications to treat it or take medications that they already have and get them as indications to get indications to use those medications. What that means is that there then becomes a financial incentive for the pharmaceutical industry to educate doctors to use those drugs when kids appear like that. Well, only one in four of them is going to go on to become psychotic. So the question is it really worth taking the risk of medicating all of those children on the grounds that you might be able to prevent it from happening in one in four? And I should add, it's not clear that you will actually prevent it.
Well, let me put that question to Debbie Dehoff, who will join the conversation now by phone. Debbie is the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in North Carolina. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I know that you take a different view of this potential new diagnosis, psychosis risk syndrome. What is that view?
Well, we have an opportunity to actually, I think, integrate research in terms of changing the DSM-5 to intervene earlier with people who may have very serious diseases. And my understanding is about 40% of them would go on to develop schizophrenia. The National Alliance on Mental Illness has really taken the position that while it's complicated, there's pluses and there are minuses. The pros really are that if you intervene early, you will save a person from experiencing many severe symptoms of their illness and actually possibly stop the progression of the illness and really affect the brain's functioning forever. Now, the cons, really, no one wants to be labeled prematurely, and the disease may not evolve. But our position is there's many ways to put in protections through clinical protocols, through setting a high threshold for prescribing antipsychotic medications, where the benefits would be there for young people.
Jane, you know, that what we just heard here points to one of the central problems. If Debbie has heard 40% of young people might be at risk and Gary's saying it's 25%, we don't have even the right numbers to get started?
That's true. What you're talking about is 25 or 40% of children who have some psychotic symptoms. They in themselves are a very small proportion of the population, fortunately. So the kind of epidemiological research that would be needed in order to come up with the correct number would involve literally millions of people followed over a couple of decades. And that kind of research is simply not happening.
Let's continue this conversation. We'll take a break right now on the state of things. Talking about the controversy over the DSM-5, our guests are psychotherapist and writer Gary Greenberg, Mike Mayer of the Community Resource Alliance, Jane Costello from Duke Medical School, and Debbie Dehoff of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in North Carolina. Just ahead, we'll take a look at the problems and benefits of mental health diagnosis. On the state of things, stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour about mental illness and the controversy over possible revisions to the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on Mental Illness. Our guests are Gary Greenberg, practicing psychotherapist who wrote about the DSM controversy in the December issue of Wired magazine. Mike Mayer is senior partner of the Community Resource Alliance. Jane Costello is co-director of the Center for Developmental Epidemiology at Duke's Medical School. And Debbie Dehoff is executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in North Carolina. Debbie, let me come back to you because Gary said something before the break about what happens if you took a diagnosis like pre-psychotic syndrome, psychosis risk syndrome. Once it ends up in that manual, the drug industry is very likely to want to make drugs for it, and they get very busy about sort of promoting this drug and educating doctors. You talked about protocols in place. Are they strong enough? Because the pharmaceutical industry is a very powerful industry and very persuasive when it comes time to selling their product.
They're probably not strong enough. I think that's the position NAMI has taken, that we need to continue to move forward on all of these fronts. But, you know, one other thing that I wanted to say in general about schizophrenia, I think it's real pertinent to this topic. Currently in the DSM, there is a durational requirement of 6 months. Now, think about moving to a risk syndrome where some of those requirements are really more, are less stringent, basically. Think about having to wait 6 months to prove that you have schizophrenia, meaning that you don't have the benefit of a diagnosis and treatment. Now, in terms of the drug companies, certainly medications are extremely important, but I think it's also important to remember that the most effective is treatments are both things like psychosocial rehab treatments as well as drugs. So we need to constantly keep moving forward with how we treat people appropriately so that we achieve really the best possible outcomes. Because discrimination is huge against people with mental illness. We know that it has resulted in discrimination in insurance, which will be righted in large part by the Affordable Care Act, certainly in employment, housing, and really all aspects of life, including the possibility of going to jail.
Gary Greenberg, what about that, the idea that intervention could really help some young people early on and that we could be robbing them of the opportunity to prevent or treat earlier a disease that can be very difficult and disabling?
Well, first of all, of course, there's nothing to stop a physician to giving any drug to anybody that he or she thinks is appropriate. But second, and perhaps more important, we have to understand that even the American Psychiatric Association has backed away from psychosis risk syndrome. They're now calling it attenuated psychotic symptoms syndrome. And the change is made to acknowledge the fact that so many of these people don't go on to become psychotic. In other words, what they've decided to do, rather than make it a prospective disease, a potential disease, is to call that cluster of symptoms today an illness. And that's where the problem arises. Not so much that you're going to prevent an illness down the road, but that right now today, that kid who came in who's a little weird and who is having some problems has this disease. And once that is established, I'm sure there are doctors who would refrain from giving drugs, and I'm sure there are doctors who would help the kids find psychosocial support and otherwise, but I'm equally certain that there would be a lot more medication with these very powerful drugs of children. And while the identity of a mental patient is really important for some people and very effective in getting them services, it is also a real problem for people to have these labels, not just the stigma of it, but in terms of shaping their identities. We're talking about adolescents. We're talking about people whose identities are in formation right now. And I think it's correct to say that there's a cost-benefit analysis to make, but then we go to Jane's point, which is that it takes years to do this kind of research and millions of people. The APA has not even managed to get its field trials going. They were supposed to start last May. There are still two centers where the field trials aren't occurring, and there are and the clinician trials questions are supposed to be answered by actually using the diagnoses and seeing what happens. 4,000 clinicians are supposed to be using them to see. They haven't even started yet. And yet this manual is supposed to be completed in just a little more than a year. So the research hasn't been done, and it's not going to be able to get done before the DSM-5 comes out. So given the risk, I would say that at the very least, there should be very conservative application of these diagnoses in the new manual.
Mike Mayer, from your position as a senior partner in Community Resource Alliance, does it make a difference for you when you're trying to do your work if there's a diagnosis, a name like psychosis risk syndrome, or you come with a report from a psychiatrist that accompanies the young person and it has an array of symptoms and some suggestions but without a particular diagnosis? Does that make a difference to you?
Well, there's two sides to that. One of which is that, unfortunately, for many people who have mental illness, they've been subject to what we call drive-by psychiatry. So it was whatever the diagnosis of the hour was that psychiatrist had gotten used to writing, or there was no psychiatrist available, and they wound up at the general practitioner, and the general practitioner flopped open a book and said, oh, it's this one. That can be more of a problem than not. The other side of that is that if I don't have a way for me to identify how this cluster of symptoms might make sense to look at, and I'll use a bipolar because that's one of the one of the disorders we've been talking about. If I can't show somebody that this collection of symptoms really is representative of that, then they're not going to be wanting to talk to me about, you know, does this person need lithium or do they need valproate or do they, one of the other kinds of medications that might make more sense for that individual to be on rather than a full-scale antipsychotic. The argument that Gary's making is, without a doubt, I believe that we need to be conservative in how we use any of these changes. I don't think it makes sense for us to run out and overdiagnose everybody. I think that's a major concern that I think a lot of people have. But I also think that by the same token, if I can save one person from experiencing 6 months of mental illness and losing their home, losing their family, losing their jobs, and all these other kinds of things, and I have done a good job as a clinician in the evaluation, and I've done a good job in the management of that through both treatment of through therapies as well as the medication, then I think that will have helped a lot of people. So what I call the diagnosis, how I label it, is not nearly as important as how do I use the information that came out of that process. And I think that's the part that unfortunately, we get hung up on the labels. I think society does gets right. hung up on the labels. But I understand the concerns, but I also think that we have to be a little more intelligent about how we're using the information across the board to be able to have people. We need to decriminalize mental illness.
Right. And it's the stigma, I think, that becomes the problem. So Debbie Dehoff, when you heard what Mike Mayer just said about this still being able to deal with this cluster of symptoms, and then what Gary says about the research being a little bit behind the actual declaration, is it not prudent to wait a bit for a diagnostic term, a definition, while you still have available to you this cluster of symptoms that anybody can evaluate and perhaps move forward with?
Well, there's this old saying, the enemy of getting something done is perfect. And I guess I feel like we continue to need to move forward as best we can, recognizing that it's very, very complicated. I think I agree with the way Mike Mayer just now framed it, that it's complicated, but let's think about the human factor. If you have an adolescent in college who's showing an emerging psychotic condition, you're desperate to save that one individual. And I guess I want to say that I think this conversation alone is just golden, because I think talking about mental illness openly is really the way to bust through the stigma, just getting information out there. And this is a complicated field.
Jane, I know there's also been a controversy over the role of the pharmaceutical industry itself in developing this document. Tell us about that. You were inside this process. Mm. What about that?
I think the American Psychiatric Association went to enormous lengths to avoid any even appearance of undue influence. So anybody whom they had on their list as a potential member of a group had to fill out long forms, and then it was several months during which they were vetting all these forms. It's one reason why the process is so behind, was the amount of time it took them to vet everybody. The result of that is wonderful people on these work groups, and I think it's important to emphasize these are very, very skilled, able, experienced, dedicated scientists. But it may well be that some of the people who are closer to the cutting edge in terms of pharmacological treatments, for example, are not on the committee because of this appearance of conflict issue. So it works both ways.
Yeah, it's interesting, Gary, because you certainly want experts in all these fields. You don't want just people off the street. So you need experts in the pharmaceutical industry on these boards making these decisions, don't you?
Without a good definition of mental illness, what happens is that the fact that we have a for-profit healthcare system in this country takes on a whole new dimension when it comes to psychiatry. While there are unintended consequences of eliminating those conflicts of interest, the fact of the matter is you have to do one or the other. You want to talk about costs and benefits. What's the cost of keeping people who are on the payroll of the pharmaceutical industry in the process of creating the illnesses that their drugs are going to treat? I think that Jane's right. The APA has been as scrupulous as it can, but the cost is clear. You don't have the people that are on the cutting edge, and why not? Because that's where they get their money. As long as the money's coming from the private industry, you'll have to go way far out of your way and suffer some consequences for eliminating conflicts of interest.
Mike?
Well, I understand what Gary's saying, and I appreciate the fact that we're struggling against the way the healthcare system has been designed in the United States. And I think that's part of the problem, to be quite candid. And I also believe that's part of why what I'm looking forward to in reform is that some of that will be taken out of the equation. I also know that about 95% of my clients are not-for-profit organizations or state governments or even the federal government who are trying to figure out what is the right thing to do. They're trying to figure out how do we identify what is an evidence-based practice for a group of individuals. And I do think that what we have operationally is a working functional definition of mental illness. It's certainly not a definitive, but it has many categories. And I think that's effectively what we're dealing with is, are we messing with our definition of mental illness and affecting those categories? And I go back to the thing that Jane mentioned earlier, is that we're decades away from having the kinds of research that we really need. I believe that we're going to have more of that information incidental to the vets returning from Afghanistan with traumatic brain injury, as we see the incidence of Alzheimer's increase. We're learning more and more about the brain. I had one individual who is a neuropsychiatrist who told me that there's more information in the last year that has come out about the brain than had come out in the 10 years prior. And I think that's an important shift that's going on. Are we still a long way away from where we want to be? Absolutely.
Jane?
We've talked a bit about categories and distinctions and diagnoses. And I think one of the things that's raised the ire of many people about this DSM process is that everything is going to be revised at the same time. If you think about that in terms of other medical conditions, this just doesn't happen. People don't suddenly say we have a new way of diagnosing all cancers at the same time. And so, but psychiatry, for various historical reasons, has got into the habit of revising everything at the same time, which doesn't make a lot of sense unless, to come back to Gary's point, unless you want to sell a book.
And it is, well, but what about that, Debbie Dehoff? I mean, the idea that psychiatry is unique in medicine and revising all of its standards all at once, is that a concern?
Well, I would say it probably is a concern, but I guess the point that I would want to make about that is people may not know it, but people with severe mental illness die 25 years before people who don't have a severe mental illness. So I think the need to integrate our treatment across primary care physicians and specialty care is really, really important. Most people who experience a mental illness are probably going to go first to their regular primary care doctor. So in some ways, I think just, again, having this conversation, increasing awareness and knowledge will really help with the health outcomes, because people are more than just their mental illness. They're a real person who often will experience a metabolic disorder problem, obesity, diabetes. And so in some ways, just having the whole thing looked at, I mean, I can see both sides of this one, I suppose.
Mike?
Real quickly, I just want to say that one of the reasons why I think we're in better shape in North Carolina than a lot of other places is because of CCNC, which is the effort across the state to try and integrate that care, both behaviorally and psychiatrically, as well as primary care, and you know, coordinate those efforts through the Division of Medical Assistance in the state of North Carolina. So,
well, I want to thank all of my guests for being on the program today. Gary Greenberg, practicing psychotherapist, he wrote about the DSM controversy in the December issue of Wired magazine. Mike Mayer, senior partner of the Community Resource Alliance. Jane Costello, co-director of the Center for Developmental Epidemiology at Duke Medical School. And Debbie Dehoff is the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Health in North Carolina. That's our program for today. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. You can follow us on Facebook, or you can see us live tomorrow in Greensboro. We're going to be at the Triad Stage, so join us for that program if you want to be in the audience. It is free. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.